the harp
week. We haven't quite reached the quorum, but we'd like to begin. So, Chancellor, if you'd find a comfortable seat. And while we have a group that has joined us, is this an organized demonstration student group? Can someone speak for the group to identify where you're from? And you're from Mankato? Okay. Well, welcome. I just wanted to welcome you here and appreciate that. Okay, we're still waiting for a quorum, so we'll officially start the meeting in a few minutes, but I think we should get underway, and first of all, okay, now we have a quorum. So we'll officially call the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order, and I'd like to first of all deal with the minutes and get that taken care of. If I can entertain a motion.
So do.
Representative Detmer, make a motion that we approve the February 22nd minutes, and is there any discussion, corrections? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, and the minutes are approved. I'd like to welcome Chancellor McCormick and others today, and we'd like to have you begin.
Thank you.
Without any delay.
Thank you, Chair Nordis and committee members. I'm Jim McCormick, and I have the privilege of serving as the Chancellor of the Minnesota State College and University System. And there are several of our presidents here today, and two of them will be involved in the presentation. And Chair Trustee Hightower will introduce the trustees during his remarks. But I also, in addition to that, want to acknowledge our student leaders are here today, faculty and staff. Thank you for coming to support the organization. Thank you very much. Chair Nordis, we've been asked to talk about our budget request and to respond to Governor Dayton's budget recommendation. As Minnesota emerges from the economic recession, higher education is becoming, I think, more important than ever. This fall, we had our fifth consecutive fall semester enrollment increase. Our full-time equivalent for last year was 158,000, but this underestimates the number of people we serve. We expect that more than 400,000 individuals will take credit courses or non-credit courses during the year. Enrollment typically grows during tough economic times as people turn to higher education because they've been laid off or would like to have some additional education to help advance their careers. Higher education is the key to the state's economic recovery. Employers come here, and I've heard this from many, because of our educated workforce. Employees with college experience on average earn higher salaries and pay more taxes. At the same time, our enrollment has grown. Our state appropriation has been shrinking. State spending per student has declined from $4,877 per student in 2001 to $3,832 in 2011. During that time, we've been forced to increase tuition to make up some of that loss, but overall spending has been relatively flat. We're requesting the base appropriation that is in current law, $1.26 billion. The governor's recommendation is $37.8 million per year cut to the base appropriation in current law. At that level, we would be below the fiscal year of 2003 of funding, even though we're serving 37,600 more students than we were in 2003. What will happen if we don't get what is requested? We will continue to make deep cuts on our campuses and in the office of the chancellor. We now have had three straight years of budget cuts. In the office of the chancellor, for example, we have eliminated 41 positions. We have closed the Center for Teaching and Learning, the Minnesota Satellite and Technology, and the Fire Center. We are vacating one floor of the office space in St. Paul and are reducing services in other areas. The college and university presidents have outlined some of the difficult choices they've had to make in the documents that have been provided to you. And two presidents, Larry Lundblad of Central Lakes College and Richard Davenport of Minnesota State University Mankato, are here to tell you what they have had to cut. But virtually every campus, we've seen program closures, suspension of programs, that is, the elimination of positions, layoffs, early retirements, and hiring restrictions. You have asked for details on this, and we will be giving you that information today. One of your questions related to what would happen if the system took a 15% reduction. To put a cut of that magnitude in perspective, if we chose only one method to make the reduction, here's what the impact would be. Staff reductions of almost 1,000 full-time equivalents, more than 15% of our total staff. Faculty reductions of 880, almost 10% of the total faculty. This would mean the reduction of 9,200 course sections, a reduction of 166,000 credit registrations, and a decreased enrollment of more than 16,000 students. Or another approach would be a tuition increase of 12%. This would increase the average annual tuition by $580 over current levels. Or the equivalent of closing two large universities, or five of the largest colleges, or closing at least 10 of the smallest colleges within the system, primarily in Greater Minnesota. Obviously, none of these alone would be acceptable, and we would likely apply a combination of these measures. But it gives you an idea of the impact of a 15% cut would have. And now, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I would like to turn the presentation over to Trustee Clarence Hightower, the Vice Chair of the Board of Trustees, to talk about our budget request.
Chair Hightower. Mr. Hightower, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Clarence Hightower. I'm Vice Chair, Vice Chair of the Board of Trustees for the Minnesota State College and University System. And I would like to introduce two of my colleagues on the board today. With us in the audience is Christine Rice, the Chair of the Board of the Chair of the Board's Academic and Student Affairs Committee, Christine. And then Louise Sundin, Chair of the Board's Diversity and Multicultural Committee. Mr. Chair, I'd just like to make a couple comments, and I'll be brief. Let me just start by talking about the board's involvement. What I want you to know is that this budget request has the full support of the board. This budget request has gone through the board processes, it has gone through our committee reviews, it has gone through public hearings, and then when it came to the board for a final vote, it was unanimously supported by the board. My second set of comments has to do with system leadership. And what we want you to know is that the board, this budget was developed in consultation with 32 colleges and university presidents, who in turn consulted regularly with the students, the faculty, and the staff. Next set of comments I want to look at is accountability. And what we want you to know is that we hold our presidents accountable for balancing the budget. They have to adhere to strict audit standards. And the fact of the matter is they're not allowed to have a deficit. It is a fact that we're facing very difficult choices. Our students are looking at difficult choices. Our students are concerned about program closures and suspensions. They're concerned about reductions in course offerings, cuts in service, not being able to get the class they need to graduate on time, and the expectation that tuition will need to be increased. And the board has those very same concerns. The board also is concerned about quality to our programs, and we're concerned about our desire to make sure that education continues to be accessible and affordable. My last comment will be around tuition. Mr. Chair, I have been on the board now for 8 years. I've seen tuition just continue to rise. But this board is committed to trying to keep tuition as low as possible. But to be able to do that, we're going to absolutely need your help and your support. Now I would like to turn the presentation over to Laura King, Vice Chancellor and Chief Financial Officer, who will provide answers to the questions that you've sent us.
I guess the chair would prefer that we hold the questions toward the end of the presentation, if possible, unless it's very critical at the time. Just in the interest of time. So Ms. King, welcome. Welcome to the committee.
And thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the invitation.
If you can place yourself by one of the microphones, it would be helpful.
It's a battle of the water bottles here, Mr. Okay. Chair. Let me take some of them out of the way.
Again,
thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the invitation. The chair, in correspondence with our office, communicated some questions that he'd like us to address in our presentation today. And so I'd like, in keeping with that, to proceed through the presentation with answers to the questions. The staff was provided with a 30 or 50-odd page document last week that's a more extended version of the answers. But I hope today to answer the questions, at least in full, with detail to follow as requested. Following the presentation, you'll also hear from the two presidents that the chancellor introduced and have a chance to hear more specifically about the leadership and the hard choices that the campuses have been dealing with these last several years. Let me start just by reiterating Trustee Hightower's remark. As we proceed through these times, we're informed by the board's commitment to financial integrity. You expect the board to steward this system, and they do that through policies and procedures that are summarized here on the overhead. Presidents and their administrations are held accountable for financial performance. We have a framework for ongoing monitoring. We have defined methods for remediation and correction, and we have indicators that we use to monitor and measure campus financial condition. Presently, we have several colleges that are on our watch list because they've had difficulty with their financial performance, and that's part of our thinking as we move into budget planning in the months ahead, and is part of the reason why we've been so diligently planning these past months as the state's financial situation has come into focus. Starting at the top, the first chart you'll see here is an illustration of the system's revenue. We have $1.8 billion in total revenue. You'll see on the left side that state appropriation, state support, makes up 33% of our revenue, while tuition and fees likewise make up about 32%. And then the various other sources that one would expect in an operation like ours. We've had some fairly strong revenue change, but interestingly enough, not a lot of change in the distribution. Appropriation in 2005 represented about 40% of our total revenue. By 2010, that had declined to 33% of total revenue. In 2005, tuition and fees represented about 33% of the system's total revenue, and in 2010, that number had remained at about 33%. The big change you'll see here is the growth in federal and state and private grants. That has increased from about 17% of total revenue to 25% of revenue, and you can see it's doubled in dollar terms. That is predominantly financial aid, and we have seen an incredible increase in the financial aid participation rate in our student population in these last 5 years. The average grant hasn't changed much, but because our enrollment has increased so much, we have more dollars moving through as a result. Revenue overall has changed about 3% per year, and if you see at the bottom there, our enrollment has changed 3% a year as well. And that explains, if you look at the tuition and fee line, you'll see an increase of 6% in tuition and fees on an average annual basis. That's half enrollment and half rate change. It's not that we've raised tuition 6% a year. We've raised tuition about 3% a year over this period, but because our enrollment has grown so strongly, our total revenues have increased. On the expense side, we similarly spend about $1.8 billion a year, and almost 70% of our costs are in compensation. We are a labor-intensive industry. We have teachers, we have counselors, we have financial aid advisors, and that all flows through as a compensation cost. This information is taken from our financial our audited financial statements, which are available on our website if you're interested. We put the links in the packages that we gave the staff, but we've just provided you here the top line information. In the staff packet, there's 10 years worth of information, and so if you want to dig further into this, it's available to you to do. Another way to look at our expenses is by activity type, and you'll see on the next slide that with $1.8 billion in expenses, we have about 50% of that is directed to instruction and academic support. Academic support is the dean's offices, it's the materials for the instructional program. If you add the student services activity to that, then you get over 60%. This has been a very consistent measure that we have watched now for over 10 years. It's our goal to have those activities represent roughly 60 to 65% of our expenses so that we can continue to direct the greatest number of dollars to the classroom and to the student-facing activities. And we have maintained that goal now for these many years. You can see otherwise around that chart, physical plant, public service, research, very single-digit activities, but for instruction and academic support.
Ms. King?
Yes, sir.
Representative Dowd has a question pertaining to this.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. King, could you explain the depreciation? I see you have depreciation listed as an expense, how that works and why exactly that's listed as an expense.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dowd. These are numbers taken from our financial statements, so these are full accrual GAAP-based financial statements, and in a full accrual environment, you would record depreciation as an expense against the asset, which in our case is over $1 billion of real estate. It's a non-cash entry, but it's an expense item in the financial statements.
Thank you.
Good? Okay. Like our revenue chart that we saw a few slides ago, we have some trends on the expense side that I wanted to draw to your attention. Again, compensation has grown about 6% in total spending from fiscal 5 to fiscal 10. Other activities, purchase services, and most notably financial aid have increased. The compensation increase here, like the revenue increase, which is explained both by enrollment and rate changes, the compensation increase is explained both by wage rate increases and an increase in the number of employees. We've added about 1,500 employees between fiscal 5 and fiscal 10. The average annual individual total compensation cost increase has been about 3.5%. So when you add up the change in benefits, health care, retirement, and wages for individual employees, that has been about 3.5% a year. But we've added 1,500 employees. And those 1,500 employees, you can see down below, we've gone from 135,000 FYE students to 155,000 FYE students. So our students have increased about 3% a year. Our compensation cost at the individual level has increased about 3% a year. And our total number of employees has increased about 3% a year. Nothing jumps out at me when I look at these numbers. They seem to be trending with our underlying enrollment levels. Expenses per FYE student, the Chancellor alluded to this in his remarks. Expenses per FYE student have risen about 2.5% a year. So even though you've been hearing about large tuition increases, and we in fact have had large tuition increases in the past 10 years, because of the withdrawal of state support that's occurred, and because we've been controlling spending, our spending at the per student level has risen very moderately. In fiscal year 10, a couple of performance measures here for your information. From fiscal 9 to fiscal 10, we experienced an 8% enrollment increase and about a 7% increase in revenue. These four measures here relate to our financial statements again, and you'll see here something called the CFI, and I don't know if this committee has heard about this. It's a new measure coming out of the Higher Learning Commission, which has responsibility for all of our accreditation standards. And they have now established it as a metric that they watch as they're considering reaccreditation of our colleges and universities. The system CFI is 3.2, and that's an improvement, substantial improvement from fiscal 9. This is a very important measure for us because it impacts their continuing accreditation of our institutions, which flows both to our quality assurance and to our eligibility and access to federal financial aid. Unaccredited institutions, of course, can't access federal financial aid, and we're not interested in managing and leading unaccredited institutions. So the financial condition of the colleges and universities is a threshold test for us. You can see that we've improved substantially from 9 to 10. That's largely due to the board's direction for colleges and universities to shore up their financial condition as they went into planning for this upcoming biennium, because we knew that you were facing a very large deficit and that there were likely to be adverse consequences for us. We wanted the colleges and universities to be as strong as they could be going into this time. And that's why you see such an improvement from 9 to 10. It's worth noting, I think, that the financial condition of the system flows directly, among other things, flows directly to our credit rating for when we enter the bond markets. And I noticed the university provided similar information to you when they were here Tuesday. When the rating agencies are evaluating us for purposes of selling bonds, which we do for our revenue fund, this information is very important to them. We just had a bond sale about 2 weeks ago, and we were evaluated by both Moody's and Standard & Poor's and received from them a double A and a double A minus rating. If we were in less strong financial condition, that would translate into a lower credit rating, which translates into higher costs to our students for residence halls and student unions and parking ramps and the things that we use revenue bonds to finance. So it's important to our students that we have good financial condition. It improves our credit rating and it lowers our cost of borrowing, which in turn translates into lowering the students' costs.
Ms. King, we have a question from Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. King, I just had a question about, is there a goal number that you're trying to reach?
Mr. King. Chair and Representative Poppy, from the Higher Learning Commission's perspective, 3.0 is deemed good, acceptable, satisfactory. They use various words for it. And you'll see in a couple of future slides that I'll provide you some information about the range of condition we have amongst our colleges and universities. But 3.0 is sort of the target that we're aiming for or better. You'll see coming up why that is.
Ms. King, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm not going to spend very much time on this. I provide it really just in case you're interested in learning more about it, and I'd be happy to spend more time with you if you are. But I just wanted to give you one more slide that explains this measure to you, because you'll hear about it when we respond to questions about our financial management. The measure has four parts to it. One part concerns what condition our reserves are in. We talk about our budget reserves. We had a question from the chair about our budget reserves. That's one element of the accrediting agency's evaluation of us. Another element is our debt capacity. Are we carrying too much debt? Are we able to add more debt? A third measure is our annual operating performance. Are we operating our colleges and universities with a neutral or positive revenue return from one year to the next? And then the final is, are we taking care of our assets? So there's four parts to it. This is a national metric that was established through a national work group of higher education officials and has now moved into national standards. We use it, and in fact, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities were ahead of the national adoption of this measure. We've been using this internally for about 7 years, and we're a part of the design work that was done nationally. And so we've got lots of history with it now. And we can see on the slide before you that another illustration of the variability and the diversity of our system is the range we have of financial performance as measured in this metric.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. King, when you say you're using this and have used this for several years, this may be a better question for Chancellor McCormick or for the head of your board of trustees. How are you using it? I mean, is it something that's evaluative? Is it something that's used, for example, in trying to determine how well the leadership on the various campuses are doing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Banyan, I would say yes to all of your questions. It's a part of the president's evaluation process. It's a part of the board's accountability dashboard and is published publicly. And it's part of the annual review that I go through with the CFOs and the presidents about their financial performance. So it is evaluative. It is something that is, the ratio itself is very volatile from year to year. So we pay a lot of attention to directionality more than absolute.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Ms. King, is it therefore also a planning piece in terms of thinking about the future of these institutions in a broader sense, or is it simply, is it a constraint, I guess, on the behavior of the administration of the 32 colleges and universities, or is it actually an active goal that they're supposed to reach, trading off against other goals they might have?
Ms. King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Banyan, those are both really good questions. I think, and I'd urge you to ask the presidents when they come up. Great. My judgment is that it's both of those things. It's a constraint on them because there's tremendous pressure on the campuses to not maintain reserves, to not invest in assets, to not do some of the things that we know here are good long-term stewardship responsibilities. On the other hand, we hold these colleges and universities to be perpetual assets, and they have to be able to function from one year to the next. So I think it acts as both. But I'd urge you to ask the presidents that are with you here today.
Thank you.
This chart, Mr. Chair, illustrates simply that we have tremendous variability, and that as we work with the colleges and universities from one year to the next, we're sensitive to the range, we're sensitive to the variability in these measures, and pay more attention to the management decisions that are moving them in the right direction. Your letter to us also asked us about our financial performance, and so I provide here for you just a summary of our most recent financial statement activity. And you can see that we are substantially a capital asset organization. Of our $1.7 billion in net assets, nearly 1.3 of that is represented in real estate. We're not particularly liquid. We hold and care for real estate and have some cash. On the unrestricted line there, you'll see the general fund unrestricted balance of $237 million. That's the number that's interacting with the state's cash flow borrowing program. Recall that we're presently cash flowing state government through Minsky's cash balances, and that's where that number shows up. Were the state not to repay those loans before fiscal year end, that unrestricted balance would evaporate. Our financial statements are interacting with the state's financial statements. And I think, Mr. Chair, members or staff, is there awareness of this circumstance? You think so? Okay.
Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Mr. Berg.
Not to interrupt here, but just to draw attention that Mr. Fitzenreiter mentioned a similar issue at the university, because the university is having, in a different manner, the state is withholding an $89 million payment from them. So both the university and Minsky are currently acting as cash flow accounts for the state.
Presently, the state has $350 million of Minsky's cash that it's using for its daily cash requirements, and that amount is changing from payroll cycle to payroll cycle. We've had a very good relationship with the Minnesota Management and Budget, and they have they've been completely honorable in their dealings with us. We have every expectation that cash will be returned before the books close, but it is a vulnerability to us, and I would want members to understand that while it looks like we have cash on the books right now, we really don't, because the state is using it.
Ms. King, is that something that's been just recent, or has this been going on for a while?
Mr. Chair, there is some history of it in very small amounts going back into the 90s, starting 2 years ago, I believe. Where's Judy? 2 years ago. Starting 2 years ago, it got really substantial.
Okay.
And shot up. Before that, it was plus or minus $25 million occasionally, but as of 2 years ago, it got up into the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Okay, thank you.
A word, if I might, about the board's reserve policy. Another question from the chair's memo. Board policy requires that campuses hold 5 to 7 of their general fund revenues in reserve. In fiscal year 2010, that represented $82 million, about 5.6% of revenues. The system by policy also holds between 1 and 2% of revenues, and in fiscal 10 that represented 1.5% in total. At the college level, these funds are all held in the colleges. They don't come into St. Paul. They're in college bank accounts. At the college level, this board policy, because we range in size to such a great degree, was a difference between $500,000 in reserves at Fond du Lac Community Tribal and Community College, upwards to $9 million at Mankato. That's another measure. Those could both be 5% numbers, but they're quite a bit different because the size of the operations is so different. I might also add that even though $81 million is a lot of money, it represents about 2 pay periods for us because of our own size. It is both a lot of money and not very much money. Where's
Representative Plowski? You have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chancellor King, just 3 questions. If the governor's budget were passed and you received a 6% cut, what would happen to the reserves? And I have 2 more questions after this one.
Ms. King?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. And Representative Pulaski, if you're able, I'll get there in my presentation, if it would be agreeable to you. I've got quite a bit left here to go, and there's a piece there that deals with that.
And would you also be able to deal with the 16% cut?
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely. Just a little more information on reserves, in case this is a new domain for you. We define reserves to be truly and absolutely intended for things that are a surprise. We don't call them reserves if you're saving up to buy a new telescope or if you have an account to pay for severance. We really intend reserves to be for things that you didn't think of or didn't know what was going to happen. And just a couple of examples to make this case. We used system reserves several years ago to loan Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College some money when they suddenly lost a very substantial relationship with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It had been a long-running, repeatable, predictable revenue source for them. They had built program around it, and it was suddenly withdrawn. That's a classic reserve use in our mind. Similarly, the campus used reserves when Southwest State Minnesota State University had a fire several years ago. They used their reserves to stand up a food service operation while they waited for the insurance proceeds to start to flow. So that's the kind of thing that we expect reserves to be used for. If you're planning on it, we don't think of it as a reserve use. And so it truly is for things you didn't see coming. To set reserves aside for just a second now and start talking about enrollment and the state relationship, the next chart illustrates for you, and again the Chancellor made mention of this, we have seen a very strong increase in enrollment in the past 10 years, and it is tracked against a decrease in state support. In fiscal 2000, state support was $4,800 per FYE. By fiscal 11, that had declined to $3,800 per FYE. We would need about $150 million more per year to hold the per FYE funding levels at the 2000 amount. That's how much of a shift we've seen in state support in the last 10 years. About $150 million more per year to have stayed steady. That $150 million shift shows up in this chart when you can see the decline in the state's investment in higher education as a portion of the total state budget. This is a 25% decline over the last 10 years, and the effects of it are rippling through.
Excuse me, Ms. King. Yes. Representative Manning?
Super quick question, Ms. King. Does this include the ARRA money that got put into the tuition? Is that included in your numbers here, or is this just the state's portion?
This is just state appropriation, Mr.
Great.
Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Banyan, just to stay on that for a second, the ARRA money for us was used for tuition mitigation. For the most part, we had some operating money, but most of it was tuition mitigation. So it wouldn't show up in the state appropriation per student expression. It shows up in the tuition numbers.
Representative Banning?
Okay. No, that clarifies. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay. As the state budget has trended downward, our enrollment has trended upward. We have in 2011 an estimated headcount service of 433,000 individual people. These are roughly half part-time and half full-time. They're very, very largely Minnesota residents, and the growth has occurred more at the colleges than at the universities, but it's noteworthy, I think, that the universities have seen about a 22% enrollment in growth in just the past year. We might not think that as we think about what's happening to the high school population, but there has been strong enrollment growth at the universities alongside the colleges.
Ms. King?
Yes.
Representative Benson?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've seen this graph before when you made presentations.
I keep checking to make sure we have the same graph in both places.
No. It's an impressive graph in terms of growth, and if you know, we consider the what we've heard regarding the number of people that will have to have a higher education degree of either 2 or 4 year by, I think, the year 2018, we're going to need to put more people in your institutions. However, I'm curious to know whether or not you believe that some of this is a product of our economic downturn, and if potentially, if things get better in the next 2 years, do you think that it'll either stabilize or plateau or go down? Have you given that any thought?
Ms. King?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we've given it a lot of thought, and we have some trepidation about it. Because at least historically, we were countercyclical. That would suggest that we're going to see an enrollment decline now as the unemployment rate goes down. We've seen some softening, but not as much as we expected, frankly. And so our enrollment outlooks for 12 and 13 are relatively flat. We'll know more in 2 years whether what we are seeing here is really tied to the economy or, in fact, we're starting to capture adult returning workers who are employed but retraining. We think there's both forces going on.
Representative Benson. Representative Hoppe. Hoppe, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chair Detmer. Ms. King, I have a question about this chart as far as a future growth or diminishment of enrollment. And I certainly our demographics are shifting in the state as they are all over. We're going to, the baby boomers are retiring, and we're not going to see the number of youth coming through our system. So I'm wondering if you have an anticipated enrollment chart that would take us into 2020, 2025, or into the future so that we could see what that might look like.
Ms. King?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Representative Poppy, we are thinking about that, and we've been studying it. One of the things that really insulates us from the high school shift is that we are predominantly adult serving already. Our average age is 26, we're mostly part-time in the two-year schools. So we're already reaching an adult population that that cushions us from the high school change. We probably have seen the same charts you've seen that talk about the everybody that's going to be in the workforce for the next 20 years already is, that kind of thing. It's pretty difficult for us to predict behavior. We believe as a strategic objective that we should increase the participation rate among adults. And were we to succeed at that, our enrollment would continue to go up even as the high school graduation rate flattens out. So I'm not able to tell you what we think our enrollment will be in 2020. As a strategic objective, we want to grow it, but we'd grow it in the adult population.
Chancellor?
Yes. Chair Detmer and Representative Poppy, and the question that you raised. I think this is such an important issue. I'd like to express a view about this because I think it has so much to do with the future of this state. There is a researcher at Georgetown, Tony Cavella. Some of you have read some of his work. He is actually very highly respected in the area of workforce. And he did a look around the country and in Minnesota. And it's his view that for us to be world-class competitive, not only within the country but within the world, that Minnesota should have 70% of our students, of our people, of our population, that would have a certificate, a two-year degree, or a baccalaureate or beyond. And I emphasize the word certificate in terms of being accredited. Now, the only way you can get there is, of course, to work on the pipeline. And we have leakage in the pipeline with certain, we have a gap. The students of color do not come through at the same rate, and we've got to close that gap, and we're working on it and actually making progress. But even if you did all that, it won't make it. We have 2.5 million people that are employed, and I think that if we were to reach that, it's not only that pipeline, but it's a swirl, because the people that are out in the workforce are going to need to come back for training, updating, I don't mean for a semester, but taking courses, stackable credentials, and so on. So I believe, and I share this with you at this point in my time, I believe that if Minnesota is going to be the kind of a state that we have been in terms of economic development, quality of life, and so on, that we've got to get from somewhere in the 40s towards 70. And a lot of this will be the adult worker coming back, the kind of improving our workforce. So I just think that's such an important issue, and it's hard absolutely to predict exactly, but we do have a strategic plan that goes to 2014 that moves us in that direction, and we've actually moved already. But I just think that point has to be made. Thank you.
Representative Poppy, you have a follow-up?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just maybe a follow-up. It is regarding certainly the high school and those ages and beyond, and then as you talk mm-hmm. about the current workers and the age of people, but I'm also wondering about just the demographic shift in the state. You know, certainly in southwestern Minnesota, we are losing population where we're growing population in the metropolitan or suburban, exurban kinds of areas. So I'm wondering, as you're looking at the enrollment growth, what kind of planning you're also making for readjusting how the higher education is going to be, how students are going to be served throughout the state. You know, certainly we have a Southwest Minnesota State University that's in the southwest part of the state, but if they really aren't going to be able to sustain their enrollment, and they're not going to probably be able to grow much in their enrollment and likely to lose enrollment, how is that going to be able to survive into, as we look at, again, 2020 or 2025, as just the total numbers are lost in that part of the state?
Chancellor McCormick?
Yeah, Representative Deller and Representative Poppy. We're monitoring that very carefully through our individual presence and our individual institutions, and it is not even in terms of this. For instance, you mentioned Southwest Minnesota. At Worthington, we now have 62% of the students in the elementary schools are Latino, and so there's a growing number there, and some of the immigration is not just staying here in the city but moving to other places. It's uneven, and of course it depends on workforce and so on. But the one thing that I've been worried about, there are certain factories and business people out in those areas that can't get enough workers. And so it needs to be monitored, I think, by each of the institutions. And we do monitor centrally the vacancies that are occurring. We do a good job on existing positions, but when it comes to extrapolating what the changes are going to be in the future, it's hard and it's judgment. But and of course our allocation formula that is always a very important factor is, does adjust to the changing populations of the system, although it at all has tended to be underfunded. So I think those are good questions, and we need to look at as best we can on the data, and each of our presidents are trying to stay on top of that. And, of course, the one thing we do particularly well, I think, in the two-year colleges is that when we don't need programs, we adjust and change and add. And so I hope we can be responsive to that, and that we'll use the best data we have.
Representative Poppy? Representative Pawlowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chancellor King, you said that to have the amount of money that you would need to take care of this enrollment increase would be $150 million if we went back to 2000. Is that correct?
Ms. King?
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chancellor King, and I'm looking at your chart, and it would appear that a good part of that enrollment increase appears to be driven by the economy, that when you look at 2007 and 2008, it begins to spike, and these would be people who would perhaps be seeking retraining or another job. You are saying you're watching this, and if we took half of that 150, we'd be at 75. It would appear you should be anticipating two cuts, one in this current legislative session, either from the governor's budget or from the state's budget, given no new revenue. And the second would be that this enrollment, just like our revenue, is not sustainable. That in the economy that is before us now, the state of Minnesota could not sustain its revenue commitment to higher education. It would appear that you cannot sustain this enrollment in this new economy either. That at some point, there simply aren't those people to go into a Minsky institution. So I'm going to go back to the Chancellor's comments at the beginning, which I don't see in writing. I wish I had. That the system is going to take at least one hit this legislative session, 6%, 16%, and it looks like it's about to take another with enrollment, which is a base cut also. So what I would hope we would be looking at would be more of what the Chancellor presented at the beginning of this presentation. What are the consequences of having these types of hits? And are you really prepared when these arrive at the campus level now, not at the system office?
Ms. King.
Mr. Chair, President Pawlowski, I hope I have that answer for you here today, and if not, we'll come back. But I hope yet in this presentation you'll hear that answer.
I hope so, too.
Thank you. If we move on to the next slide, just to illustrate the allocation shift that's gone on here in the last 10 years, in 2000, appropriation represented 67% of the state of our spending per student, and by 2011 that had fallen to 43%, and tuition had overtaken. So we'd have essentially a reversal of the relationship. When we look at that relationship on a per student basis, you'll see in the next graphic that our total revenue per student has gone up about 2% a year. That's a combination of both state appropriation and tuition. So again, as you hear about tuition increases, keep in mind that we're not spending those tuition increases on top of a stable state appropriation. We've used them in the past years to trade a state appropriation dollar for a tuition dollar, and had no more in the end from a spending standpoint. If you were to adjust this chart for inflation, we've had an absolute decline in resources available on a per student basis. Tuition increases are shown here in dollar terms. To Representative Moore Banyan's question about the ARRA funds, we show them here in dollar terms, and I thought I had something written here, but I don't have it. The next chart shows you what those are in percentage terms. I think it's noteworthy that it's been several years now since we had the large double-digit tuition increases, and the board in the last 5 or 6 years has been very committed to holding tuition increases down in moderate terms.
Ms. King, yes. Representative Benson has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You was in a couple days ago and presented, I thought, some very intriguing numbers, too, regarding the part of the tuition that really impacts what income level.
Right.
And I really would like, and I know you don't have that today, it's not in your slides, but if you could, with a follow-up, we found that from $0 to $60,000 household income, there was really, since 2009, there was no impact to the actual student, and then I think it was 60 to 100, it was about 250, and then above that it was a 7.8%. I'd like to see how that really impacts the student, if you could make that information available.
Ms. King?
Certainly, Mr. Chair and Representative. We had hoped to have it for you here today and didn't quite get the data set to behave. So we're working on it, and we will provide it for you. We know from our recent past that the combination of the board's moderate tuition increases and the growth in the grant amount for the Pell program translated for a large part of our students into a tuition reduction in the last 2 years, I believe. But we're working on that, and we'll get it to you.
Ms. King, we have a question. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's kind of a follow-up to Representative Benson's, I believe. You talked a lot about cost of attendance versus the actual cost of tuition, and I'm just wondering, I think, if that kind of can be figured in, too, or that may be part of
It.
The description that you I just appreciate seeing that.
Absolutely. One more slide about tuition, and then I'll move into
King,
budget planning.
Representative Rickavina.
Chair and Representative Benson, and I appreciate those, you know, little charts we get from the university and from Minsky and that, but just a point of clarification. Mr. Fitzenritter the other day said that for a Minnesota undergraduate student, resident with a parent's income or their income of less than, they hadn't seen much of an increase. But if you're a graduate student in, you know, some program, if you're going on to a professional degree in dentistry or whatever, they have seen huge, huge increases at the University of Minnesota. So, you know, I don't know if you have any specific categories for graduate degrees in that where your tuition increases or tuition figures are different than what we're going to see as averages, because you know about averages, Ms. King.
I'm a big fan, Mr. Representative Rukavina. I'll look at that particularly. I'm not remembering the data on the graduate students, so we'll make sure to look at that particularly.
You know, but I just wanted clarification on that because you kind of generalized and it was specifically for Minnesota resident undergraduate students.
Is that it? Anything else? Representative Rukavina?
No, I'm fine.
Representative
just
Benson?
Just wanted clarification.
Thank you, Representative Rukavina, for that. But my guess is that probably the large percentage of the numbers that we're seeing up here and that you would provide would be the undergraduate
That's
and below with junior colleges and technical colleges
That's
and
right.
like. But he does make a good point. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, if I couldn't represent
Rukavina,
too,
yep.
we should probably, again, have it broken down by two-year institutional two-year institution specific. Community colleges like Dakota are almost purely technical in a sense, and there may be differences in their tuition increases there too, because you know some of those technical programs at auto mechanics at Dakota Community College are much more expensive than you know a two-year liberal arts AA degree might be, and we have seen recently, at least there have been, you know, some kind of complaints that. In this, as the pressure gets put on Minsku, that a lot of the programs being cut are more of the technical programs, high-cost programs, although there's been, you know, some argument on the case of Minsku that that isn't the case.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, we'll take the data as far as we can. I'm quite certain we can't take it down to the program level. We can, I think, take it to the institution level. But we'll push it down as far as we can to get to the total cost of attendance. And the net price question.
Representative Rukavina, anything else?
Okay.
You know,
thank
proceed.
You, Mr. Chair. Yeah. The next chart illustrates for you, once you leave the Minsku environment, what our tuition rates compare in the general competitive higher education marketplace. At the college level here, at our two-year college level, our tuition and fees total for fiscal 10 was $4,900, and we range in the two-year colleges from $4,500 to $5,300. And that compares with the list illustrated here. You could put, I think, virtually any of the private, nonprofit, or for-profit two-year schools on this list, and we would be substantially less expensive. Similarly, on the university side, the Minnesota State University average tuition is $6,600, and here we range from $5,900 to $7,200. And again, we're the least expensive on this list, and you could put anybody on this list, and we'd be the least expensive. But it does, I think, respond to some comments we've heard from members about Minsku's tuition in the marketplace. This illustrates for you what that looks like. Moving then to employees, if I can set the tuition question aside, the next chart shows for you that we had in fiscal 10, 15,600 employees. And if you go around the chart, the three groups at the top, state university faculty, state college faculty, and adjunct faculty represent about 55% of our employees. And moving around to the right there, you'll see administrators slash managers. That represents about 4% of our employees. So we have about 600 administrators and managers and 15,000 employees that are part of an organized labor bargaining group. About half faculty, the other half are staff, whether it's the AFSCME group, the MAPE group, MMA, State University Service Faculty, or the supervisory group. State appropriation, and moving now into Trustee Pawlowski's questions, and then I'm hoping to wrap it up here in about 20 minutes, I want to make sure to get the presidents up before you. Starting in fiscal 11, we had a state appropriation of $605 million. Our forecast base in 12 is $630 million, and the governor's recommendation in 12 was a cut of about $37 million per year cutting us down then to $592 million per fiscal year. You can see this chart is constructed the way the law is constructed. This is the way our appropriation looks in law. The first line is the allocation that is directed to the colleges and universities. The second line is the allocation that's directed to the chancellor's office and to our service cooperative group. And then the third line came to us from the Minnesota Office of Higher Education in some kind of a deal at the very highest levels some years ago, and it's now carried in our bill for $4.5 million a year. The chair asked us to speak to reductions, and so we have here the math, just so that you can see the scale of the numbers. If we start from the forecast base of $630 million a year for a biennial total of $1.2 billion, a 15% reduction against that number is $190 million over the biennium, and a 20% reduction is $250 million over the biennium. If we were to replace that strictly with tuition, which is a question that I know members have asked, it would be a 12 to 16% tuition increase in the first year to substitute student dollars for state appropriation dollars. When we look at building our budget challenge for 12 and 13, we start with the appropriation base, which is that plus $50 million from 11. We add in this 15 to 20% appropriation reduction. We then add what we think of as sort of the natural cost increases that are happening if we do nothing from a leadership standpoint, and that's about a $50 million a year pressure. That is predominantly the inflation in law in our health insurance programs. That number does not have any assumption for compensation increases. It has a very modest assumption for CPI increases. It's mostly the benefit cost increases that are coming through the consolidated benefit program. That leads us with a budget challenge at the 15% level of $290 million and at the 20% level at $350 million. You heard the Chancellor mention in his remarks another way to scale this number. It's in the magnitude of closing 3 to 4 of our state universities or 14 to 16 of our colleges statewide. That's the scale of numbers we're getting to when we look at numbers this size. We started in the Office of the Chancellor last fall, working both with our own leadership group and with the larger presidential leadership group to do budget planning around the state's outlook. We made some assumptions about the possible range of adverse consequence we were facing. In the Chancellor's case, he was very clear to us that he wanted a budget solution adopted last December so that we could go through the legislative session and start the fiscal year on a good financial footing. That led us to make some pretty substantial changes in the Chancellor's organization last fall and yet this spring. We reduced the Chancellor's office budget by $4 million, and we've eliminated 41 positions through retirements, resignations, and layoffs.
Ms. King, Representative Pawlowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chancellor King, we've heard a lot about the 41 positions, and I've got two questions here. The first is, can anyone tell me how the elimination of those positions impacted the campus level or program level? What isn't being done that should have been done or needed to be done or could have been done? And then the second question is this. Have you hired anyone since you laid or eliminated 41 positions?
Ms. King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, the Chancellor's challenge to us was to try to undertake this budget planning in a way that minimized the impact on the campuses. So the things that I'll talk about here aren't service or work shifts to the campuses, but rather services that went away. For example, the elimination of the Center for Teaching and Learning. That was a service of great benefit to the campuses. We eliminated it, and the campuses are now making their own judgment about whether they want to go out and find their own professional development resources for faculty development. Similarly, we have substantially downsized the Fire and Emergency Management Center, which was a service that grew out of the technical colleges. It started out as a curriculum development service and then has migrated over the years into a general emergency management, emergency response training program. That training is now gone. Those regional resources are now gone, and the campuses are looking elsewhere for that assistance. We tried and I think succeeded in not eliminating any work that the campuses were required to replace, but we did eliminate quite a bit of services that the campuses found useful and are now making their own judgments about replacing. As to your second question, yes, we have hired people since the layoffs that occurred as part of this plan. We have not increased the overall headcount. We have hired replacements and filled out authorized staffing plans where there were vacancies.
Representative Paulski.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Vice Chancellor King, that would explain as late as Friday then. I have had no complaint from the campuses as to any impact from these layoffs or resignations or retirements or from the programs. So that would explain why I haven't had a complaint. I am curious, though, as to how in this environment was there a compelling need to hire new people? Because we don't hear about you hiring new people. We hear about you laying off these positions or eliminating them. So why was there a compelling need in the environment that we're in to hire more people? And how many did you hire?
Ms. King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, it is in the normal course of business that you identify your strategic objectives and your high-priority activities and your low-priority activities, and you hire to your high-priority activities. And that's what we're doing. We continue to replace vacancies in areas that are of priority, and we will continue to do that.
Well, Mr. Chair and Vice Chancellor King, this is not a normal business situation. This is about as abnormal as I've seen in 24 years. And you have just repeated what the Chancellor stated at the beginning. You anticipate the elimination of entire universities, colleges, and I would assume at the very least, programs. So I don't think you can go under the normal course of business here. This is something that is extraordinary, and I would anticipate that there would be an extraordinary performance by the central office in response to it. You don't need to respond to that.
Okay. Ms. King, Representative Poppy has a question.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. King, as a follow-up, I think, to Representative Pawlowski's comments, just regarding the elimination, and I'd like to know the number, the total complement of employees prior to the 41 eliminated, at the point of 41 elimination and currently. And again, you may not have that right now. If you do, I appreciate it. If not, just I'd like to be able to know what those are.
Let me get it to you, if I might.
King,
thank you, Mr.
Ahead.
Chair. We'll follow up and provide you with that. And I would expect that were you to have any more questions, to be sure and be in touch. Let me, if I might, talk a little bit about what's happened at the campuses. The campuses have also undertaken their budget planning, and I think many of you in your home districts have seen newspaper stories about this. We've had 27 colleges and universities that have already announced position reductions, and at this juncture, it's approximately 680 positions have been identified to date. 17 have taken advantage of the board's early separation retirement program. And I have either already effectuated those retirements or we can expect to see them over the next 18 months. 14 have announced planned closures, and the tally to date is 81 programs have either been closed or are tagged to be closed in the coming cycle. And 21 of the colleges and universities have preliminary plans for 2012 that illustrate a need to use their reserves or their fund balance in order to balance their budget. And these budget plans in 2012 are based on assumptions they're making as you do your work. They have to make some assumptions, and those assumptions will tighten up as we get an indication of where the legislative session is going, and then they likewise will tighten up their budgets. I think this illustrates for you that over the past 3 years, the presidents and their leadership teams and the rank-and-file staff and faculty have been living with very difficult budget environments, and I've had it said to me repeatedly they're in an environment now of continually cutting their budgets. And we see that in the articles that we read about other budget participants. So this is, you're reading about this in your local newspapers, and your constituents are likely talking about it and thinking about it. It's very much going on the campuses right now, with a target for them of bringing the uncertainty of the legislative process to an end before the fiscal year starts with a budget that then works.
Ms. King, Representative Benson has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A follow-up to Representative Pawlowski's, and that, just given the budget situation we're in, whether you use the governor's 6% or, you know, you've been requested to plan for 15 to 20, and I don't think that anybody's stating today that that's, you know, what we envision necessarily, but at least for you to prepare for it. Do you not think it not, you know, just working in higher education, not to this degree at all, but I just understand how people begin to apply and look for jobs and be they faculty or whatever. And given the scope of and the magnitude of this potential, would it be a prudent thing to do to say we're going to put ourselves in a hiring freeze?
Ms. King?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have, in various degrees at various times at different places, that announcement has been made. It's a tool the presidents and the chancellor use as they're entering into a planning cycle. The other side of that, though, is that these are dynamic, changing, vital organizations, they need to hire in order to be competitive and successful. So the presidents and the chancellor balance very, very tricky counter pressures.
Ms. King, Representative Pawlowski has a question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Vice Chancellor King, I'm looking at your bullet point. The closure of 81 programs, does that impact your enrollment at all? And if so, how?
Ms. King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, the campuses, and again, you'll have presidents here in a few minutes that you can ask this as well. The campuses have a very robust evaluation process that they go through as they're looking at programs. The best case is that a program closure does not impact enrollment. But more often, I think their modeling makes some assumptions about an enrollment impact. But let me urge you to ask the presidents that you'll have here today.
Well, Vice Chancellor, Mr. Chair, Vice Chancellor King, you and the Chancellor have made statements about the impact of 6% and 16% of closing entire universities and colleges, certainly programs. Would that impact your enrollment?
Ms. King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, I wouldn't want anyone to walk out of the room here today, having concluded that it is our intention to announce the closure of a university or a college. We provide those numbers in order to respond to questions from the chair and to scale the consequence of what we're facing. It's absolutely the case that if we were to close an institution, we would have an enrollment impact. I think that's a reasonable conclusion to reach. But we are not here today to announce a closure.
Representative Pawlowski.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chancellor King, I didn't ask you to announce it, but I am asking you to plan for the severity of the situation that we face. That's all. And I would hope that Minsky would be as equally aware of it as we are. You don't need to respond to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I'll proceed, if I might. Again, continuing with the requests to speak directly to some illustrations of the impact as laid out in the chair's letter, a 15 to 20% reduction This chart is designed, the math in this chart is designed as if we were to use only one of these methods. And, of course, we wouldn't use only one of these methods. But, again, it gives you the range of impact on the numbers. As I mentioned earlier, the colleges and universities have started planning some time now. Just a few illustrations of the kinds of pressures that they're juggling. Of course, salary and benefit increases, utility and debt service costs. On the revenue side, we're having some extended conversations around tuition assumptions, enrollment growth. Enrollment growth continues at many of our schools. That has both a revenue effect and an expense effect. And then on the expense containment side, we are well launched on a shared service cooperative, which we talked with you about last year. And this is our continued effort to consolidate administrative support. That's certainly a tool for us. We're likewise very engaged in collaborative sourcing, and that's a tool for us. So there's been great work done on the productivity side, as well as on the enrollment side. I'm going to introduce President Davenport and President Lundblad and ask them to come to the table. Before I do, let me just close with what we've challenged the presidents to do as they think about their financial strategies. We've been working on multi-year budget planning now for some years. The board has a policy of regionally competitive tuition, and so you'll see different tuition rates at different colleges. That's on purpose because we recognize that each of these colleges and universities operate in their own competitive environment. There's been great emphasis from the chancellor and the board for the development of outside revenue sources. We have an allocation model that I've been in front of you in past occasions talking about. This allocation model is tied to both cost management and enrollment. We are hopeful of modest tuition increases. We're quite concerned about that given what's in front of us, but our principle would be to maintain modest tuition increases. And, of course, we have great uncertainty around collective bargaining. So presidents have a lot of assumptions to make in their planning, and that's why we encourage them to start early. And we've asked both President Lundblad and President Davenport to talk with you today about how they've done that planning, what decisions they've made, how difficult it's been for them and for their community, and the principles they're holding forth as they proceed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We look forward to their testimony. Mr. Representative Rukavina.
I could with Ms. King. Laura, on slide 29, to go back to it, just a couple
slide
back.
Slide 29, okay.
The three are still back there.
Yes.
Do you have further information there on, you know, how, what staff you're talking about? Are you talking about middle management? Are you talking about, you know, AFSCME and the janitors and that? Are you talking about MAPE employees? Are you talking about vice presidents? What percentages are included in those, you know, staff FTE reductions? And the same with faculty. Are they broken down to, you know, the technical programs versus university and two-year institutions, or is that a, you know, any way to do that? And the course sections, again, the technical programs versus more of the liberal arts programs. And finally, on the student, you know, again, on averages, and kind of going along with what Representative Pawlowski was saying, I mean, if you take a 10 or a 15% hit that it can be versus a Normandale or Century, you know, or Bemidji versus St. Cloud, you're talking some significant numbers for that institution and community. So, I mean, I know that's a hard question maybe for you to answer, but have you worked in variables in there that protect certain programs and certain staff and certain institutions that, you know,
right,
you've had to pay special attention to in the past?
Right.
If you care to respond later,
Just briefly, okay. If I might, what you have on this graph isn't that elegant. If you go through the individual institutional...
I don't think there's any elegance involved in any of this.
Well, maybe I should say isn't that...
Intricate.
All right, that's a better word. If you go through the individual institutional profiles that are in the materials we provided you, you could see a distinction between faculty and classified. We can go through and try to count those up. It's more the 800 that was in an earlier slide. This is just to illustrate scale. On the student FYE illustration here, we already have enrollment capping going on. We have many, many schools that have closed programs or limited access as a budget balancing device. And this just turns that into how many FYE would we be impacting. We haven't picked which programs they would be. Mr. Chair,
Representative Morrow has a quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's really following up on this because I had to be educated on what the student FYE meant. Okay. And it sounds like it's no room at the end kind of approach. I mean, we're telling 16,000 students under the 15% plan, we don't have room for you. And I understand that Wisconsin may already take this approach as a budget-solving measure, that Minnesota hasn't historically done this. But one of the solutions, or one a possible part of the solution, is to tell 5, 10, 16, 20,000 students there's no room at the end. Is that the way to understand the FYE number?
Ms. King?
Mr. Chair, President Morrow, that's exactly right. This would say we would be unable to serve that number, and those are students that we have today. They're not even students that we wish we could recruit if we had more resources. There'd be students we have in the house today. And that's before we talk about the increase we should be pursuing as an economic development or intellectual investment argument.
Representative Banyan?
Perhaps I'm particularly sympathizing with Representative Morrow as a fellow faculty member. Let me give you a feel for what that's like. At our university, we've had to make some reductions, get some reductions going on in my department. And the answer is, how do you serve the students? And the answer is, of course, let's go get bigger, let's have larger classes, right? And none of us like larger classes, but that's not even the biggest problem. The problem is, where do you find a room large enough to house them all? Right. We went around and counted. They were telling us that we needed to have classes of 90 people. And I walked around the campus and said, how many rooms would have 90 chairs in them that I can put them into? And the answer was, I could count them on two hands. Mm-hmm. So when you decide we're going to reduce faculty, we're going to reduce staff, the cuts in students come naturally because you simply don't have the physical space to put them all into anymore. You don't need to respond to that. Because we teach at slightly different institutions, I wanted to put a face on that for
response
you.
From Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Banyan, I agree. I mean, having been a department chair, I've had to struggle with these very things. When we lose faculty, right, we lose sections. But we don't lose student demand. I mean, you and I probably both dealt with the students, understandably, in tears at registration time saying, where's the section I need? Well, we couldn't schedule the section. Why? Because we don't have the faculty member. Why? Because we don't have the room anymore. Why? Because we just can't afford to do it anymore. But they still want to graduate, and they still want to graduate in 4 years. So I think, yes, we have different institutions, but these are very stark numbers that we're both have a history of struggling with.
This is probably a good segue into the president's.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. We'll follow up. People are taking good notes, and we'll get answers back to you.
Okay, thank you very much. We have a little over 15 minutes left, so we need to move right along. President Davenport, Lundblad, and is it Straka? Is that the last name?
Straka.
Okay. And who is who got the short straw?
Me.
So go ahead, introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Dornis and members of the committee, I'm Richard Davenport, president of Minnesota State University. I've been president there for 9 years. Thank you for the opportunity for us to share our story, our budget challenges with you today. As you know, Rick Strucka is our Vice President for Business and Finance, and we also have in the audience from the university today, we have the President of our Faculty Association, Dr. Roger Severance, and we also have with us a member of our student government leadership, Michael Doe, and they're sitting in the front row there. Today our presentation will focus on two topics. Number one, the approach and process that we used in making some very painful and hard budget reductions. And the second focus is on how funding reductions are negatively impacting our ability to meet student needs and the higher education needs of Minnesota today. And I've heard from the representatives here today echo probably some of the things that I'm going to share with you as well. Our university community found it necessary to fully engage in conversations regarding both short-term and long-term budget planning. And we worked with, under the assumption of a number of significant reductions projected in state appropriations and the need to keep tuition affordable. For example, we estimated that the state budget gap would be between $5.8 and $7 billion. And that's what it appears to be in that category today. We estimated that base budget reductions of 15 to 22% of appropriations would be a factor. We also assumed that results in spending reductions of somewhere between $6 and $10 million would be necessary at MSU Mankato. The university assumed and was challenged by the budget forecast for fiscal year 12. We challenged our university community in seven ways as we began the process about a year and a half ago. We challenged the university to, number one, to realize the seriousness of the statewide budget situation and the negative impact that it would have on higher education. Secondly, we challenged the community to examine ways that we could be even more efficient in what we considered an already very lean university. We challenged them to reduce costs, to reduce academic programs and services for our students. We challenged them to rethink the priorities, how we work and how we meet the needs of our students, not only on our campus, in the region and statewide. We challenge them to utilize the whole university community, including faculty, staff, and students, in this process of helping to solve what I think has been the most serious budget crisis in higher education since we've existed. We also challenged our university community to develop a very thoughtful budget reduction approach that was not simply an across-the-board cut to programs, but focused really on statewide needs, on the workforce, on economic needs, and we examine every single program at our institution. And finally, we challenged our community to not sacrifice quality in the process. And I have to tell you, quite honestly and sincerely, this was perhaps the most challenging and continues to be the most challenging of all the challenges at our institution. Our planning involved the use of really hard data when it was available, and we had to estimate many unknowns, such as future health care costs, employee contracts, utility costs, and so forth. So we utilized academic metrics, and the academic metrics that we focused on are the kinds of things that any university would look at in making important budget reductions. We looked at every program in relationship to the institutional mission, the mandates as a university, as a comprehensive university that we were required to live up to. We also took a look at cost and enrollment on a per program basis. That is, of course, instructional cost per program. We looked at mission centrality, and we looked at quality as it related to, and is measured also by accreditation and program review. And I think equally important, one of the really critical pieces that we use in our metrics had to do with our job placement record of our students and workforce needs that we understood existed. The process also is very transparent. You're probably aware that on our university college campuses and our college campuses, the consultation is a big part of our environment. And so consultation was a part of our bargaining units and with our students, of course, during the formal meet and confer process. As you can see from the slide, there were monthly meet and confers to talk about the process. We had special joint meetings of planning, budget, and assessment of sub-meet and confers. Utilized the email system for all staff announcements. We had town hall open meetings. Proposed budget reductions so that every person on the campus, not just the administration, the deans, and department chairs, would understand the significance of it, but every single employee, including students. So we had a portal, online portal, where we could get feedback on a regular basis. The input regarding the establishment of academic metrics was very important in the final decision-making process. The public announcement then that we moved through that consultation process was very open and very transparent as we proposed the elimination or reduction of programs. And in that process, we utilized the metrics that I talked about for all programs. We also took a look at administrative reorganization and downsizing, made important and critical academic program decisions, and we heard appeals. So not only did we make the announcements of which programs were on the chopping block, and we had a lot of input from students, as I reiterate, but we also wanted to hear what might be wrong in our thinking. Was there something that we missed? So we had the opportunity for every department and program to file those appeals, and they were all heard. We then, of course, filed individual retrenchment notices, and while this was all going on with the faculty, we were doing the same thing in the non-academic or in the non-instructional side, and issued a number of individual staff layoff notices. The outcomes of the budget process, I think, are fairly significant. And I want you to understand that we, our university committee, university, took seriously the seven challenges I talked about in the beginning. And as a result of that, they knew these budget cuts were coming. And we did announce these cuts, and we have moved forward with the cuts. On the instructional side, which, by the way, most of you probably know makes up somewhere between 70 and 80% of the total budget of any college or university, we identified 77.5 faculty positions to be cut. Originally 21 programs, but after review and appeal process, we ended up cutting 15 programs. One program we didn't cut, it was our aviation management program, because the community of Mankato and the region stepped up to the plate and raised $600,000 in order for us to keep that program important, I mean open, because it was important to the community. Not only on the faculty side did we make cuts, we also on the staff side had 28.5 reductions in staff positions. We also did a number of reorganizations throughout the institution to run a more efficient operation, and we cut five administrative positions. So all in all, roughly, I believe the number is about 111 positions cut at Minnesota State Mankato, including four the varsity sports programs have been identified for elimination. So you can see this has been a very, very difficult process for us. Next slide.
Representative Rucavino.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, President Davenport. Just so I understand the last slide, outcomes of budget process. If you know me, you and I know each other good, and I'm not very smart, so, you know, and you've got a, you know, doctorate, and I got a doctorate in life, I like to think. But anyway, let me follow this trail here. So I understand this, because you got 77 and a half faculty positions that you have eliminated. 15 programs. And you have 28 and a half staff positions. Is that everybody from a vice president to a janitor?
Yes.
So I'm not under, then I must really be dumber than I even thought I was. So the reason we have a higher education institution is to teach people. The instructor is the basic person in the trenches. Everybody else is staff support. You mean there's you're going to lay off 77 and a half teachers? One of them must look like me, right? Anyway, and the other one, and you're only, and there's only 28 and a half other staff positions to eliminate?
Mr. Chair and Representative Brookavina, that's a good question. And let me just say that one of the reasons that had to be in that way is because a high percentage of the total budget rests with the faculty.
Mr. Chair, I just can't follow this logic, because I realize that a high percentage is with the faculty, but there's no reason for anybody else to be there. If the faculty's laid off, who in the hell's on it? Why are they going to the school? To look out the windows? I don't understand this. You mean there's only one-third of a janitor, one-third of a cook, one-third of a vice president, one-third of a whomever, counselor, whatever, for each teacher? I don't understand what we're doing here. Why the teachers seem to be taking a much huger hit, the instructors themselves, than the vice president and the, you know, the everybody else involved.
I understand the concern, Representative Brookavina, but we have 4 minutes left. We need to hear from the other college yet before we run out of time. Can you somehow get an answer
another method? And I could also talk to Representative.
I mean, would the other institutions be the same typically as this here?
I would say the answer to that question I project is yes. But I have to tell you that, and I'll give you a very brief answer and a more elaborate answer later, but Mr. Chair and Representative Ruckavan, one of the reasons that our students are successful is because of the student support services that we have. That makes up a big part of a university. We're a residential university, meaning that students come there, the high percentage of students stay there, and we have to take care of their basic needs. That's food and lodging and making sure they...
But if there's no classroom to take, why feed them? Send them home to their parents.
Well, the programs that we cut, Mr. Chair and Chair or Representative Ruckavina, were programs that were not high market demand programs. They were programs that we looked at very, very carefully, programs that would have the least impact on students. And so I could talk extensively about that.
I want to further get more information into that from somebody. And one quick question. How many of the 77 and a half faculty were adjunct, and how many were IFO or whatever?
Right. We were tenured and probationary. This is Rick Strachan, Mr. Chair, Representative Ruckavina. We had about 12 faculty members that were probationary or tenured. We had about, I'm thinking about 30 fixed terms, and we had about 50 adjuncts. So, but adjuncts may teach one course, so they might be, you know, a less than about a tenth of a person or so. So when you add all those up, that's what it comes up to. So the vast majority were fixed-term positions. Adjunct positions were required by contract in program to start at graduate assistants, go up to adjuncts, go to fixed terms, go to probationary, and then to tenure.
Representative Morrow, quick question.
I know, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I do apologize. I mean, this is the essential conversation, and maybe we need to stretch these out or have people come at different intervals. So I'm just going to ask you to provide the information. You made certain assumptions when you made these cuts. You made certain assumptions about what the state funding was going to be. What I would ask you to do, and in part because I represent a good deal of your workforce, is would you at least provide to the committee what happens if there's a 15%? And what happens if there's a 20% cut? What happens in Mankato? And there may be members who have other institutions, but since you're here, would you provide that information to the committee? What you, this is just to get you through what you think was going to happen, not the cliff that may happen to you.
Actually, this is the 20% reduction.
This is the 20%?
This is the 20%. We had to plan out, based on our contractual guidelines, we had to start planning actually in October of 2009, with programmatic decisions made March a year ago and faculty positions made last summer. Okay. So we had to project that far out. So we had to go with a worst-case scenario, plan for the worst, hope for the best.
So tomorrow.
Just to clarify, that was, then maybe I should work the other direction. If it's a 15% cut, would faculty positions at least conceivably be restored?
Representative Bandy,
just wanted to ask. I promised I'd be quick because we have another speaker. If you, you said you had an appeals process, you had 10 probationary and 12 tenured, or was that a combination of both? And if so, you said you had an appeals process. Did any of the appeals lead to you changing your mind about something?
Yes, as I indicated originally, forecast 21 programs were to be reduced. We ended up actually only cutting 15 of the 21 that were originally earmarked.
Members, we're going to probably extend about 5 minutes of our hearing here if we can do that, and if Mr. Lundblad can condense his presentation.
Okay, we were just working.
Sorry to do that to you, but
30 seconds.
Chair Nordis, representatives, we're very pleased to be here as well. I'm Larry Lundblad, president of Central Lakes College, and we're undergoing the same discussions at our college as well, though not in the magnitude, of course, of Mankato State or St. Cloud State. We have been focused for the past several years very closely in our budget. Some of the discussion you heard earlier that you had with Vice Chancellor King, ratios and focus on viability of the college, we've been very focused on that. Central Lakes College, just to put it in perspective, we have a headcount of about 6,000 students, just a little over, an FYE of about 3,500 students. We've had a 42% increase in the past 4 years. We serve basically 7 county areas where the majority of our students come from, and those counties are some of the most disadvantaged counties in the state. And so as we start to look at making cuts, not only are we focused on classroom and trying to be as efficient as we can with the number of sections and instructors we have, but we also have to take a look at the students that are coming to us. Many of the students are first-generation students where neither parent has gone to college. We have a lot of returning veterans. We have a lot of individuals that have been displaced workers. We have 1,200 individuals in our campus ahead this fall over the age of 25, and these are individuals coming back for work training and looking to get back into the workforce. So a lot of our students are bringing a lot of stress, a lot of concerns with them that we need to address, and as we start looking at making cuts, unfortunately, we start looking at where we can become as efficient as possible, but we also have to start to prioritize. And so we're very concerned about the future, of course, and the cuts that perhaps we will have to make. Kari Christensen, CFO of Central Lakes, will explain our process that we've been using to focus on 15 and 20% reductions to Central Lakes' budget.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Kari Christensen, Central Lakes College. Chair Norns in committee. Larry has talked a little bit about the region that we serve, and I will compress my discussion to two items. First, what an impact of 15 and 20% state appropriation reductions would be for Central Lakes College, and then move into our specific budget planning. At Central Lakes College, our current base appropriation is approximately $10 million, and so looking at a 15% base reduction would be approximately $1.5 million. again, if we solve the shortfall with only tuition, we would need to increase tuition by approximately 14%, which would increase what our students are paying for full load from $4,400 to over $5,000, or approximately a $700 increase for a full-time student. If we were to solve the reduction solely through personnel cuts, we would need to cut 20% of our workforce, or 20 positions, excuse me, approximately 7% of our workforce. If you look at that, if you look at approximately 50% of those cuts coming from faculty, that would be a reduction of 110 course sections, approximately 280 FYE, or an 8% overall reduction in our FYE. At the same time, when we reduce faculty, as there has been conversation here, that would reduce our tuition revenue by about $1.2 million. So there's a compounding effect, as we've previously discussed. As you look at a 20% base state appropriation reduction, again, that would be about a $2 million reduction, 19% tuition increase, 27 positions, or about 10% of our overall workforce, and an 11% FYE reduction. And again, that would reduce our tuition by approximately $1.6 million. I just need to indicate that these reductions come on top of reductions that have already been made. We've talked about career and technical programs, investment in equipment, and support of those. As we look at our budget for next year, we have about $250,000 in true equipment, most of which can go to our career and technical programs. It's just a small fraction of what they need to keep our programs up to date. And then we also have a very extensive consultation process on campus. We talk to our college community about reserves. We talk to them about our overall assumptions. We have been planning with multiple scenarios on state appropriation, enrollment, tuition, inflationary pressures, and whatnot. We have made the decision we are not going to use reserves to balance our budget for the upcoming year, and as has been mentioned, we have been planning for reductions. They're very, very difficult, and they have wide-reaching impact, but the reserves are for unplanned, or unanticipated events. We've been planning in the range of budget shortfall between $1.2 and $2.4 million at Central Lakes College. And when you look at the proposals that we're bringing forward to our college community, we're solving that approximately 50% with personnel reductions. We would need to reduce approximately 12 positions. We've had two program suspensions and faculty layoffs. And the rest of the faculty reductions would be with our temporary part-time and adjunct faculty. And the balance would come from operating budget reductions and revenue increases.
Okay, thank you. One final question, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just stated that you're not going to use your reserves, but you're at 7% in fiscal year 10, and I'm just wondering, since other colleges seem to be doing going to 4%, some are at 3%, and the state university is certainly 5%, I think, is a reasonable, responsible level, as Ms. King stated. Is there a reason, again, why you're not reducing even by 0.5% or 1% or something to kind of ease your way through these times?
Who could respond?
I guess Chair Norton's representative. At this point, we are striving for overall financial viability, and as Laura talked about earlier, with our with the financial indicators and pressures that are out there, we need to increase the financial accountability, and so we are doing our best to plan for a balanced budget with the assumptions that we have. And if those assumptions change, then that may change the answer on use of our reserves.
We need to conclude our hearing, and we thank you very much for your presentation. Just to note that the private college scholars will be at the Capitol Monday from 11 to 1 in the rotunda with some displays. So if you have time, put it on your calendar. Meeting's adjourned.